Welcome to the book show. I'm Alex Papajohn.
And I'm Jack Singer.
This is Cutting Edge Talk about Cutting Edge Books. And this evening we're going to be talking to Bill Salmon. He is the White House correspondent for the Washington Times and political analyst for Fox News Channel. And he's been a commentator on so many talk shows on television, that is, too many to count. And we've got a two-for-one special tonight on the book show, folks, because we have two books that Bill Salmon has written. The first one is At Any Cost, How Al Gore Tried to Steal the Election.
Yeah, he tried hard.
He did.
he tried as hard as you can do.
He did that. And the second book is Fighting Back, The War on Terrorism from Inside the Bush White House.
I like the quote from Al Gore. I'm not like George Bush. I'll do anything to win.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's not the public persona that he projects. But
Of course.
At Any Cost is a breathtaking examination of Vice President Al Gore's audacious and unprecedented effort to overturn the presidential election. And Fighting Back is the ultimate insider account of the Bush presidency during the days and weeks following 9/11. Both books, in my opinion, were captivating and very informative, and perhaps, arguably, my favorite story from At Any Cost is when Mr. Ellis, I don't know his first name, but Mr. Ellis, he's a cousin of President Bush, and he worked for Fox News, okay? Uh-huh. And it was election night, and remember, the election had been called.
Oh, yeah, we were in a car driving back from New York, weren't we?
Yeah, we were driving back from New York. The election had been called for Al Gore, and then the networks retracted it.
Yep.
And then, okay, it was still really, really close. But Fox News, this guy Ellis at Fox News, called the election for George Bush.
Correct.
And for competitive reasons, the other networks really needed to call it also for George Bush. And what that did, though, is it made Bush kind of the presumptive winner.
Mm-hmm.
And psychologically, you know, he then, in the eyes of the public, was the president.
Absolutely.
Okay, or president-elect. And so Al Gore was the challenger. And a lot of Democrats to this day seethe because they think that if Ellis had not done that, that it just would have been considered kind of a tie or, you know, not determined yet.
Well, you heard what that Pelosi lady said, though. It was yesterday, the day before yesterday. It wasn't a valid election because not enough Democrats voted.
You know what?
And this, is that the biggest joke?
This is one of the bogus things. A lot of Democrats argue, you know, they don't like the Electoral College now. Al Gore won the popular vote. But look at it this way. The networks, CBS, ABC, NBC, called the election for early in the evening, well before polls, even in the panhandle of Florida, let alone the rest of the country. And the estimate is that in Florida alone, there was something like 22,000 votes. Approximately 22,000 Republican votes were not cast because of the call made by the networks. And if you extrapolate that nationwide,
around
2 million votes. So in other words, what happened was because the networks called the election for Gore, a lot of Republicans were discouraged from going to the polls. So the argument that Al Gore got more in the popular vote, it probably would not have happened if the networks didn't call it.
Right. I noticed they were much more conservative on this past election.
Yeah. All right, let me run through really quickly, folks. If you want to give us a call here at the studio, the number is 788-0990 or 1-877-WLEE-990. Coming up today on the book show, we're going to talk about what's news in publishing this week with author, journalist, and e-publishing guru MJ Rose out of New York City. For all of MJ Rose's books, including her newest release, Fleshstones, although it's not new anymore. It's been out for a while.
But still a great book.
It's a great book. Fleshstones. Go to www.mjrose.com. We're also going to announce any new contests for writers and authors in our Contest Corner segment towards the end of the show, sponsored by Writer's Digest Magazine, America's number one magazine for writers. And later in the show, we're going to announce America's best-selling books the past week. These are America's top 10 best-selling books the past week, according to the USA Today. And for those of you who are new listeners, the book show is about books and the people that write them. And our slogan is Cutting Edge Talk about Cutting Edge Books. We like to interview authors who have written books on hot topics, timely issues, provocative and controversial subjects. And these two subjects, At Any Cost, you know, how Al Gore tried to steal the election, and President Bush's performance.
Absolutely.
After 9/11. These are
to talk to him.
Hot topics. Absolutely. Well, do we have MJ Rose on the line?
MJ, are you there?
I am.
Howdy.
How are you?
You found her new time early.
Yeah, I like this time.
Yeah, so do I. I can get home in time to still eat something.
Yeah,
me too. The Harry Potter movie's coming out. It just came out, right?
It just came out. My daughter went there opening day, yes.
You know, I actually can't hear Alex.
Can't hear Alex?
Can you hear me?
No.
Sorry,
really.
I dropped my papers on the floor. All right, I'm back.
Can you hear him now at all?
Can you hear me?
Barely.
Barely.
How
right, our man on the board is working on it.
No, it's still the same. It's like just some distant, faraway sound.
Distant, faraway sound.
Now,
all right.
There you are. There you are.
Okay,
okay,
great.
Good. We got
great,
it.
Great. We got it.
We were talking Harry Potter.
Yeah, Harry Potter.
Yeah, a lot of censorship this week. Everywhere I looked and everything I read this week, it was about something that had to do with censorship, starting with Harry Potter.
Mm.
Lots of people want to censor Harry Potter, especially a preacher in Lewiston, Maine. Harry Potter makes you dirty. Did you guys know that?
It makes you dirty.
Yes, that's what he says.
You know, I think people just read too much into these books versus taking them as what they are, entertainment.
Yeah, well, this guy led a group of people into shredding copies of Harry Potter on the eve of the release of the new movie, Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Have you guys taken your kids to that yet?
Well, yeah, my daughter's already gone to see it. I didn't get a chance to,
yeah.
Only because she went with some of her friends, her girlfriends, and they said it was actually better than the first one, and I was just amazed because I loved the first one.
Yeah, I loved it too. Well, this guy, the Reverend Douglas Taylor, told 30 supporters before he brought out the scissors that he felt like he was in a cutting mood tonight. Don't you think that's just a little too gleeful? I mean, who exactly here is getting the press, and why?
Right, right.
I think people are, like, finding things that they can do to get attention in the press related to books and censorship and really jumping on the bandwagon.
I think you nailed that one on the head. You're exactly right.
Because, I mean, you know, how many people have read Harry Potter books?
How many millions.
Millions
and millions.
And how bad is, like, the witchcraft warlock population among children become? Do we have an overflux of witches in our schools these days?
It's just good versus evil, and good wins out in most of the story plots. It's just, it's a great, enjoyable, fun movie.
So it's a publicity stunt.
Book, yeah.
Yes.
It's bizarre.
Publicity stunt. What I'm wondering is, why is this story relevant? I mean,
well,
why would the AP carry a story about 30 extremists who want to cut up Harry Potter books?
Because I think it fits in with the rest of the news. I mean, the second major story this week was about the U.S. government pressing ahead with efforts to censor a book about China's nuclear weapons program.
Right, and that's your story.
Yeah, and they're asking an appeals court to block a former government scientist from showing the disputed manuscript to his own lawyer.
Mm.
What's so controversial about the book? This is a new story to me here.
The district judge, Emmett Sullivan, said that the government had violated, is saying that the government is violating Danny Stillman's First Amendment rights by denying his lawyer access to the book, and
mm-hmm.
he's saying what's in the book is information from the scientist who was formerly with the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico.
Right.
And you know, that's the one the other scientist came out of 2 years ago, who was arrested for being a spy.
Correct, yes.
And the government is citing national security grounds for holding up publication of the book. And the case is still before the district court. And I think that we're, you know, heading into a time of a lot of slippery slopes between the government wanting to protect what they think is dangerous information from getting into the hands of the public, now that the public is not such a safe and pristine sounding idea.
Well, I can understand if they're telling in the book, how do you build a nuclear bomb? But beyond that, it should be freedom of the press.
Right, and we don't know because we don't know what's in the book.
Right.
But the book is called Inside China's Nuclear Weapons Program. And I don't think that necessarily sounds like it's going to tell you how to build a bomb. It's based on the man's trips to China between 1990 and 99. And they're claiming that the government is claiming the information was classified and can't be published.
Well, you know, there may be something else behind this. For example,
publicity to sell the book?
Well, no. What if...
No, well, the government wouldn't be helping.
That's true. You're right.
If they would, I have a book for them.
Yeah.
Perhaps if this information somehow got out into the public, and perhaps if the Chinese got their hands on it, perhaps they may be able to root out American
spies
or something. I mean, maybe they may be able to attach the dots, in other words, you know?
You need to change the names to protect the innocent.
Yeah, and as opposed to getting involved in something that doesn't sound... I mean, I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm certainly not a First Amendment lawyer at that, but it just... There are too many of these stories. I mean, I just picked out three this week, but it seems in the past 6 months, every week there are censorship stories. I don't remember that from like 2 years ago, and maybe that's just a sign of the times with terrorists, but maybe it's something else. I mean, not to get into a political discussion, but maybe it's part of the signs of a somewhat Republican administration, or a Republican administration, and now a Republican House and Republican Senate. Maybe we're just in a different, you know, a not as liberal time, and not speaking politically, but certainly speaking book-wise, that's never good for books, because censorship is, you know, always just hiding behind the surface, ready to rear its head.
Well, I would think that the amendment rights are going to come through and the book will be published.
I hope at least his lawyer can see the book. I mean, I find the most absurd. His own lawyer can't even see the book. How can his lawyer fight the case if he can't actually read the book?
Yeah, that doesn't seem to make sense to me.
His lawyer has confidential rights with the client. How can they do that? And the third case is just really fascinating to me, because on Tuesday the Supreme Court is going to be deciding if public libraries can be forced to install software blocking sexually explicit websites. And this is all because Congress is really struggling to find ways to protect children from internet pornography, while at the same time not infringing on free speech rights for website operators.
Right.
And the problem is that they've passed three laws since 1996, but the Supreme Court keeps striking them down.
Right, the ACLU keeps stepping in and striking them down, because I know our local libraries tried to put it in place, and they were forced to take it back off, despite little, you know, second and third graders using it, and it's all popping up on the screen in front of them.
Now, forgive me for being, like, really stupid here, but why can't there be different internet, why can't there be different computers in the children's section of the library that the kids can use versus the ones the adults can use?
I think at bigger libraries they can do that, but the libraries near us aren't big enough. They've got a couple of public access terminals and that's it.
Yeah, so can't they, like, move one into the children's area, and if an adult goes in, there's some code word the adult can switch off, but if a child uses it, the librarian sets it to use? I mean, is this really this complicated that the Supreme Court has to get involved in this?
I agree with you. I guess
sometimes this stuff just seems so simple. I mean, you keep kids out of movies because the person who lets them buy the ticket looks at them and says, you're a child.
Or just have it set up so that the librarian gives you an access to it, just
right,
like you check out
a
book. And she can hit a button that says, yes, you're an adult, or no, you're not. You're right.
And we can't, like, figure this out by ourselves. We have to take this to the Supreme Court.
I think we need to invent some software. Let's make some money on this.
That's a good idea. Let's make some money.
Yes.
It's the filtering technology.
I think it's already in existence, and I think it's just called password encrypted sites.
I don't know.
It's the filtering technology, right?
Yeah.
It needs to be more sophisticated.
Well, no.
Or just easier.
No,
just
ease
of use.
That's impossible. See, that's impossible. I'm having this problem with my own website right now. I got email from somebody in Tunisia who said that he went to my website for my book, and he wasn't allowed access, and he couldn't figure out why, and he was writing to ask me why. He wanted to read an excerpt of my book. And I said I had no idea why the government of Tunisia was blocking him from looking at my website, but as we corresponded back and forth, it turned out because I have words like sexy in the reviews of my books.
Mm. Yep.
And that's enough for their filtering system to block him from looking at my website. So that's not really a solution, because there are a lot of words in the English language that have double meaning.
Well, I read about this about 3 or 4 months ago, that a website, might even been a government one, where someone was trying to get some information on Dick Cheney, and just because of his name, they were literally blocked for that reason.
Right, exactly my point.
Have you ever gotten a book order from Nigeria?
Yes. I got book orders from all kinds of countries, a lot from Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia?
Yeah.
For
my e-books, because people there were telling me that they couldn't buy my books because they were too erotic, and the only way that they could read the books was by buying e-books, which for some reason their internet sites were not blocking them from just buying whatever they wanted in e-book format.
Right.
Oh, that's good to know.
It's really good, by the way, guys, and anybody listening, if you want to make some real money, e-books of difficult subjects in countries, third world and other countries that have very strict codes about what can be read, e-books kind of get around that.
Interesting.
I also know about a lot of people in those countries who use sites like yours, and BookLocker to print books or to print e-books on subjects that are highly controversial within their companies under pseudonyms so that they can actually get their books out and to the public when they're really about things that their countries don't want them to be talking about.
I'd be really careful about getting any orders from Nigeria. Nothing against Nigerians, but
there's a lot of financial scams.
There's a lot
scams
of scams, and I know a publisher here in Richmond, Virginia, and they received a reasonable size order from Nigeria, and there was an immediate chargeback or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so be really careful.
Well, I didn't take the charges myself. They went through Amazon. I just got mail from people in Nigeria saying, "Can you direct me to where I can buy your ebook?"
Oh, I see.
So I just sent them to Amazon.
Perfect. That way you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, but I must get about 20 of those emails every week saying, I'm a high-ranking Nigerian government official and I have $1 million that I can't get out of the country.
Yeah, I've gotten
that.
If
you give me $10,000, I'll give you half of the million. Yeah, right.
I've gotten that one, too. MJ, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Have a great week.
Talk to you soon.
All right, MJ Rose, author, journalist from New York City, doing What's News in Publishing. We are going to, in just about 30 seconds, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Bill Salmon.
Bill Salmon.
We have two books, At Any Cost, How Al Gore Tried to Steal the Election, and Fighting Back the War on Terrorism from Inside the Bush White House. This is the book show, Cutting Edge Talk About Cutting Edge Books, on WLEE Hot Talk 990. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Welcome to the Book Show. I'm Alex Papajohn.
And I'm Jack Singer.
This is Cutting Edge Talk about Cutting Edge Books, and we are going to be talking to Bill Salmon, White House correspondent for the Washington Times. And we have two books, At Any Cost, How Al Gore Tried to Steal the Election, and Bill Salmon also has written his most recent work, Fighting Back the War on Terrorism from Inside the Bush White House.
Yeah, thank God it's how Al Gore tried to steal versus how Al Gore stole the election.
Well, you're right. You're right about
Bill,
that.
Bill, are you there?
Yes, I am. Otherwise, I'd be writing how about the war on terrorism from inside the Gore White House, I suppose.
Right.
How the U.S. gave up the country to terrorism under Al Gore.
When did you decide to write this book, At Any Cost?
Well, At Any Cost, that's the book on the post election recount wars in Florida, of course. I decided to write that while I was still down there covering that 36-day nightmare. Regnery, the publisher, actually called me before it was ever resolved and said, you know, this is going to be a great book. And I actually didn't want to do it, but he finally talked me into it. I'm glad he did. And then of course, this other book, Fighting Back, was sort of the same way. You know, we getting into this, obviously, after 9/11 hit and the terror of that, it became apparent that there would be a story to tell from George W. Bush's perspective, what his world was like during those traumatic events, and so I decided to write that book.
Right. Now, you write, you're the White House correspondent for the Washington Times, and I'm from the Washington, D.C. area originally. I'm from Alexandria.
Oh, yeah.
And Washington Times editorial page is decidedly more conservative than the Washington Post's editorial page. And you've come out with a book, and I heard that Bob Woodward has come out with a book also.
That's right.
Now, is his book on a similar subject?
Yes, it is. In fact, it covers much of the same territory. It doesn't come out till Tuesday, but it I have a copy of it, and it I've read it. It covers really remarkably a lot of the same thing that I do. Obviously, he has certain, you know, different perspectives and different angles on certain things, and there's some things he has that I didn't have, and there's some things I have that he didn't have. And as I expected, the books, I guess you could say the books are complementary. Neither of them are terribly ideological as books.
Okay.
In fact, I refrain from either praising or criticizing the president's prosecution of the war, and I'm trying to tell the story of what happened, and I think that's sort of compelling enough as it is.
Right. Well, can we start off with a few questions about At Any Cost?
Sure.
I'm interested to hear about you on the premature call for a Gore victory in Florida and how that affected Republican voters in the Western Panhandle from voting.
Well, in the Western Panhandle of Florida, along the Gulf Coast, there are 10 counties that are on the Central Time Zone, that are in the Central Time Zone. They're on Central Time. The other 57 counties east of that are the Eastern Time Zone. So when the polls closed in the Eastern Time Zone, they were still open for another hour in the Western time, in the Central Time Zone, and yet the media, the networks called the state of Florida for Al Gore, even though these 10 counties, which are by far the most Republican counties in Florida, okay, were still open, and it influenced the outcome. A lot of people got out of line. A lot of Republicans that were headed to the polls or in line just said, "Oh, the heck with it! The state's already gone to Gore." And it actually depressed turnout. There were three separate studies done, one by a Democratic firm, one by a Republican firm, and one by a university. And all three of them came to the conclusion that this premature and erroneous call of Florida by the TV networks cost George W. Bush a net loss of some 10,000 votes. And remember, 10,000. This whole thing hung up over 537 votes for
right.
36 days. So 10,000 right. votes. Even if those studies were wildly exaggerating it, even a fraction of that would have comfortably given Bush the election
sure.
and spared us all of this nightmare for 36 days.
Now, all of the networks apparently share the costs, or shared the costs, in 2000 for something called VNS, the Voter News Service. And there was a problem with VNS's system, right, when they were tabulating the results. And wasn't that the root cause for the bad calls on the election?
Well, VNS, and I spent a lot of time in that book explaining the problem with VNS. And it was basically a train wreck. And I tell you, I feel a little bit validated. I haven't really said this before anywhere else, but this past midterm elections, you notice that the VNS exit polls, right in the middle of the election night, they decided, you know what, they're so screwed up, we're not even going to issue them.
Yes.
And I was the only one saying that back when I wrote this book, that their exit polls were a train wreck. They had, I talked to some insiders at VNS, and they told me that, first of all, they have what they call a democratic bias that is built into their polling model. It's something that exists. They've tried to compensate for it. They've tried to weight around it statistically. But in poll after poll after poll, the Democrats seem to do better than they actually perform in the election. So their polls are structurally flawed from the get-go. So they favor Democrats even when the Democrats aren't doing that well.
Right.
Secondly, you know, VNS basically consists of a bunch of people who are not professional pollsters, very well-intentioned housewives and students and part-time people or retirees who they hire for one day to go poll people coming out of polling places. And, you know, sometimes you have to stand across the street, and sometimes, you know, people don't talk to you, and it's just very imprecise.
Right.
And so they get a very sketchy view of the results, and I detail that in my book.
Now, your subtitle is How Al Gore Tried to Steal the Election, not How the Press Tried to Steal the Election. So I'm curious, how did Al Gore try to steal the election?
Well, I thought long and hard about using that provocative title. Initially, I told my publisher I didn't want to use that, and then later on, and he agreed, and then later on, after I finished the book and really reflected on everything I had found out, I said, you know what, that actually is perfectly legitimate title, because he tried to take away the election by illegitimate means, which is the definition of attempting to steal something. And, you know, and I'll give you an example.
Okay.
The military ballots cast by overseas members of the U.S. military.
Right.
They were expected to favor Bush, and Gore mounted an all-out effort to disqualify as many of these ballots as possible, even when that meant throwing out perfectly good votes that had been cast by brave men and women risking their lives overseas. Had one example of a guy who was over there helping rescue the USS Cole, which had been bombed by the Al-Qaeda terrorist network in October of 2000. This guy jumps into a little tugboat, you know, goes up against the coal right next to that big crater that had been ripped in the side of it, and he pushes that thing out of that harbor and out to safety. And he had voted at that very time, 8,000 miles away in Florida, in Jacksonville. Two Gore lawyers are disqualifying his ballot and high-fiving each other. I think that's a bit much,
right?
To become the commander in chief of the United States.
Right. It's sort of like that statement Al Gore made: "I'm not like George Bush. I'll do anything to win."
Exactly, and I have that. That's one of the things I have in the book. At one point, Al Gore actually sat his advisors down at his residence in Washington, the vice presidential mansion, took out a big easel and a tablet of butcher block paper, and he wrote four concentric circles, and he said, "These are my circles of responsibility." And in the outermost circle was the nation. The second one in was the Democratic Party. The third one in were the labor unions and some other NARAL and some other interest groups. And the fourth centermost circle was Al Gore and Joe Lieberman. I mean, I thought that spoke volumes of his priorities.
Right.
When you put your own skin above the country and you want to run for president.
You think Al Gore's going to run for president in 2004?
He sure is making noise like he is. I'm astonished that, you know, I was on Fox earlier today and we were talking about this, and I was saying I don't understand the conventional wisdom on this, that somehow Gore emerges stronger from the midterm elections as the sort of the party standard bearer.
He hid in the closet during the elections. This past one.
Well, I think the logic behind that, Bill, was that Daschle decided not to be confrontational and to be take moderate positions on taxes and on the war, and Al Gore is pushing a little bit more for a stronger liberal platform.
Well, I guess I can see that line of logic, but the bottom line is the Democratic Party, I don't buy this nonsense about the Democrats didn't have a message. They had a message. It was rejected. The message was pro-tax, anti-war. That didn't sell. And now they're suddenly claiming, well, we didn't have a message. No, they did have a message. And Gore was practicing that message, and so was Daschle. And, you know, Gore was down here in Maryland campaigning for Kathleen Kennedy Townsend.
Right.
Just before the election, and one of the things he was saying was, remember where you were in 2000 when you found out the election had been stolen. Hold on to your rage. Hold on to your anger. That's what this election was about. And that's not what the election was about. I mean, the issue of legitimacy and when it comes to George W. Bush is over.
Yep.
And so I think Gore is really representing the past. I don't think he's electable. I mean, I'd love to see him get back in. I guess it would be great for book sales.
Well, he runs on negatives where the Republicans run more on positives.
Exactly.
That's the big difference I see.
Exactly.
All right, well, why don't we turn to Fighting Back? This is your most recent book, The War on Terrorism from Inside the Bush White House. The chapter that you call bifurcation, explain to us what you mean by bifurcation.
Well, I mean that the presidency of George W. Bush was sharply bifurcated by the terrorist attacks of September 11th. You had that first phase, those 8 months prior to September 11th, which were rather mundane months in terms of this president. He was consumed with small potatoes issues like, you know, arsenic levels in drinking water, and there were still some media recounts from Florida that were still hanging around, and small bore issues. There were a couple big issues like stem cell research, but mainly his presidency was kind of going nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
He was derided as a lightweight who didn't have a foreign policy presence, didn't have much of a domestic policy. And when this unwanted and unwelcome war was foisted upon him, 9/11, it bifurcated his presidency. And now the war on terror has become the be-all, the end-all of his administration. This will be his focus till he leaves office, whether it's in 2 more years or 6 more years. Mm-hmm. And nothing's going to knock him off of that course, not even charges that he's politicizing the war. He's just like...
Oh, the Democrats never would do such a thing.
Never.
Never.
No, they would never use anything for political gain. We understand that.
Now, what about the economy, stupid issue? Do you think that's going to come to play on the re-election of George Bush?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if it really takes another hit, obviously that could be a problem for the president. But you got to remember that in these midterms, you know, we've had the economy not doing all that great, and yet Bush led the Republicans to historic sweeps.
True.
In both houses of Congress. So, you know, you got to think that in a couple more years, that hopefully the economy would be doing a little bit better.
Right.
And then maybe there'll be no stopping them. I just don't think the Democrats at it's obviously very, very early, but you know, at this stage, it's difficult to foresee some Democrat knocking Bush out of there in 2 years.
I think if the economy is doing reasonably well, he'll be really hard to beat.
Very hard to beat.
But if the economy is still not doing well.
Yeah, the economy's cyclical, though. I mean, it's going to go up and down all the time, so it's
right.
Good timing.
I mean, and I was at the presidential press conference about 10 days ago or less, and I asked the president, you know, now that I think it was 2 days after the election. It was a Thursday after the election. I said, now that the 2004 presidential campaign has unofficially begun, you know, are you going to keep Cheney on the ticket? And he said, was. But he didn't dispute my premise, which was that, you know, this campaign has begun. And he's out there making decisions like, you know, who's going to be his running mate already. And the Democrats are still wondering whether it's going to be Gore, whether it's going to be Kerry, whether it's going to be John Edwards. And there's going to be a long, long process of elimination here for the next 2 years, while President Bush is basically going to be unchallenged on the Republican side.
Right. I was wondering if Colin Powell was going to step up to the plate for the vice presidency, but I guess after this past week or so with the United Nations support that he gave, and now George Bush seems to be unhappy about that. It's doesn't look like that'll go away.
No, well, I mean, I think one of the reasons Bush bit on that question I asked him about the vice presidential slot was because he wanted to quell speculation about Colin Powell, about Condi Rice, about others who have been talked about as a potential running mate for the president. A lot of people think that it would be politically wise for the president to put someone more vigorous, more perhaps younger, on the ticket who could carry on in 2008 and become sort of the, you know, the, be groomed for the next president, as the next president. Cheney has publicly stated he does not have any interest in being president. Plus, he's got the health issue. He's a little older. And so this would leave the Republicans in the position of, you know, finishing up with Bush and Cheney and then not really having anyone to hand it off to, perhaps. So, but Bush wanted to quell all of that and say, no, he's the guy I'm sticking with, and, you know, that's it.
It's hard because Cheney's done such a great job.
He really has. And, you know, you think about how people, when he was first selected as the running mate, people go back a couple of years, thought, oh, you know, what's he picking Cheney for? You know, Wyoming's got two electoral states. You know, what, you know, but I tell you, that old guy has come in handy. You know, you want someone like Cheney and people like Rumsfeld. They were all derided as sort of the retreads from the Ford administration, but now it looks like they come in handy now that we're at war, because they've sort of been around the block a couple of times.
Now, in this book, Fighting Back, it's basically a play-by-play as to how the administration and the president reacted from 9/11 onward, right?
Correct.
And any observations, extraordinary observations about the president or his close circle that you'd like to share with us?
Well, he was, first of all, very generous with his time for this book. He granted me a series of extensive interviews in the Oval Office on Air Force One. I even got to question him down on his ranch in Texas. And he filled me in a lot about, you know, what was going through his head at different points in this drama. Also, I'm a White House correspondent, so I travel with the president wherever he goes. And part of that means listening to the same speech day after day, but the other part of it is you sort of get a window on his world. You get a feel for what it's like, not so much to be president, but what it must be like for him to be president, what he faces on a day-to-day basis. And so I decided to write about, you know, sort of like what it's like to be president. I mean, not only is he fending off these foreign threats, but he's also constantly dealing with the loyal opposition, who is, you know, which is probing and prodding and finding out when will it be safe to attack him on the economy, when will it be safe to attack him on foreign policy, and then thirdly, he's dealing with the sort of naysaying press all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, the reporters were saying almost instantaneously that this war in Afghanistan was a Vietnam quagmire.
Right.
So, you know, I tried to sort of create the swirling Washington milieu that a president finds himself in.
I loved what Daschle said last week, how the war on terrorism was a failure because they have not gotten Osama bin Laden.
Well, yeah, you know, that is almost exactly what he said back in January of this year. And I have him quoted in my book saying almost precisely the same thing. He said, we will have failed without getting Osama bin Laden or Mullah Omar. And it caused a real big stink at the time, and it was poorly timed, because right after he said it, we were in the midst of Operation Anaconda in the caves of eastern Afghanistan, and there was a terrible mishap, and I think it was 8 Navy SEALs were killed. And so just as he's leveling this, you know, sort of the first criticism of the prosecution of the war, you know, we have sort of like our worst batch of American casualties. And so Daschle at that time backpedaled and introduced a resolution of support, a sort of a symbolic resolution of support for our troops and for the president in the Senate, hastily introduced. And so we covered that at the Washington Times. But here he is basically doing it all over again. That's what I don't understand. The strategy didn't work in the midterms. They got clobbered in the midterms by picking apart the president's prosecution of the war and arguing for higher taxes. So they get clobbered. What do? They just start all over again. I don't understand how that's a winning formula.
I guess he's just testing the waters again to see if it's a little bit better this time. Who knows?
Perhaps.
You have any idea how Bill Clinton would have reacted to 9/11 if he were still president?
Well, I do talk a lot about that in the book in terms of he rued the fact that he was not president when this struck. And he thought that he would be, in fact, he said that he would be better equipped to handle this crisis. He told Paul McCartney's fiance in New York that exact statement. And there was some other indications, too, that the New York Times did a piece shortly after 9/11, front-page piece, that said that he was telling friends that, you know, how he felt, you know, out of sorts because he wished he was in the game again and handling this crisis. You know, there's a lot of irony here. Bill Clinton was the guy that was always looking for a legacy. And towards the end of his term, he would ruminate to friends that, you know, really, to be considered a great president, you must have overcome a great national challenge like a war or a depression or a recession or something like that. And he had presided over 8 years of peace and prosperity, so that he wasn't going to really get a chance to be ever considered a great president, if you will. Now, here comes George W. Bush. Everybody thinks he's a lightweight. In fact, the rap on him was that he was not seeking a legacy. He was trying to sort of downsize the presidency. And all of a sudden, he gets hit with this historic war, plus a recession to boot. And, you know, history will have to wait to see whether he is ever regarded as a great president. But certainly, unwanted circumstances have thrust him into contention in a way that Clinton never was.
Right. Bill, we're going to take a real quick break. Can you hold on?
Absolutely.
We're going to have you back. Bill Salmon, author of Fighting Back, The War on Terrorism, from inside the Bush White House, and At Any Cost, How Al Gore Tried to Steal the Election. We're going to have Bill right back in a moment. This is The Book Show, Cutting Edge Talk about Cutting Edge Books on WLEE Hot Talk 990. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Book Show. I'm Alex Papajohn.
And I'm Jack Singer.
This is Cutting Edge Talk about Cutting Edge Books. And we have been talking to Bill Salmon, author of At Any Cost, How Al Gore Tried to Steal the Election. And his most recent book, Fighting Back, The War on Terrorism from Inside the Bush White House. And this book is available at all of your favorite bookstores, Borders, Barnes & Noble, I'm sure, Amazon.com, and BarnesandNoble.com, Books A Million, and many more stores. Bill?
Bill, I got a question for you.
Sure.
On almost every conservative author that we've interviewed to date, I can go through the web and I can see, my gosh, the negative comments about that author and how the author didn't know what they're talking about. Now, I tried to find the same information about you, and I couldn't find any, basically, information to fight back comments that you make in your books. Is it because of the accuracy factor, do you think that is, or what?
Well, what I tried to do is not take an ideological stance. And, in fact, I did a bunch of TV shows. I did Hannity and Combs on Fox News Channel.
Yeah, watch that. I watched that.
The first question when the camera went on and we were on the air, the first thing that Alan Combs hit me with was, and he said, "I have just read this entire book, and I can tell you this is not a partisan book." And then, of course, he just proceeded to beat me up on other things. But I took that as a high compliment because that guy's looking for any opening to nail you.
Yeah.
And I really didn't take a political stand here, but what I did was this. The book has a ton of criticism of President Bush. It's not some sort of a Valentine to the guy. What I did was in addition to describing how he prosecuted the war on terrorism, I go behind the scenes of the loyal opposition as well. James Carville, Bob Schrum, Stanley Greenberg, they were meeting with reporters on the morning of September 11th. Here in Washington, while I was down with the president on the morning of September 11th in Sarasota, Florida, in that elementary school when he got the news. But I described the scene, I described both. Reporters up here in Washington basically, look, guys, we did some fresh polling. This president is in over his head. He doesn't know what he's doing. And they were basically sort of licking their chops with glee that this guy was so vulnerable and it's going to be so easy to take down. Now, right after 9 o'clock, as the meeting started to break up, a few minutes after 9, word came into the room where the Carville was meeting about the terrorist attack. So Carville jumps to his feet before the reporters can leave, and he announces, "Disregard everything we just said. This changes everything."
Yeah.
And for a while, he was right. I mean, it really did change American politics, where there was this rally around the president effect, and everybody was kind of united for a while. But then, as the book chronicles, that evolved slowly back to, as we said, you can attack them now on the economy, and then maybe you can attack them on the war, and pretty soon it got back to the same old way that Washington's always been.
Do you think great American presidents become great because of the circumstances in which they find themselves, or because they're just great leaders themselves?
Well, I think it has to be both. Franklin Roosevelt might not have been considered a great president if he had presided over peace and prosperity. Some historians believe that he didn't have the right temperament and priorities to do great things in a tranquil time. But he certainly is regarded as a great president for winning World War II and getting us out of the Depression, although there are some critics of some of the things he did. And the same is true with President Bush. I mean, and we touched on this earlier, is that, prior to 9/11, he seemed like a rather mundane president. He seemed destined to continue on that path. I remember September 10th, Gallup did their approval poll, Bush was down to 51%, which was an all-time low for him. And then this terrible tragedy was foisted upon him, and people saw him in a different light. And one of the central questions of my book is whether this president was fundamentally transformed by the events of 9/11 and all that followed, or whether he is the same man he always was, and that we just saw some of these leadership qualities because of these different circumstances. And I ask him that repeatedly, and he doesn't really like to be too introspective. You ask Clinton about his feelings, we'd still be hearing about it. You ask a Bush about his feelings, they don't want to go there.
Bush's inner circle will argue that these qualities have always been there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And my reporting tells me that that's probably closer to the truth than the theory about fundamental transformation.
Right.
Because, you know, you either have leadership or you don't. I don't think it can be magically acquired in the midst of a sudden crisis. But that's not to say that he wasn't changed somewhat. I mean, I think all Americans were changed by 9/11, and I think the president was no exception. I'll tell you one quick example of an area where he did tell me that he was changed, and that was he said that this whole thing sort of drove home for him the purpose of the presidency. Now, obviously, he understood theoretically what the purpose of the presidency was, but it wasn't until this tragedy happened that he understood in his gut that the purpose of the presidency is to find a couple of big goals for the nation, just one or two, and try to unite as many people as you can and go for the big goals and forget about all the nickel and dime, you know, budget squabbles and whatnot. And I think that really changed the way this president looks at his job now, is because he's sticking to a couple big goals.
Right. Well, one last question. Is George Bush, let me reframe that. How does George Bush make his decisions? Is it himself and a few close confidants like Rove and Karen Hughes, and then he consults with Vice President Cheney? Do you have any feeling for his decision-making process? Is it consensus among a lot of people, or does he listen to people and then it's himself and a couple of really close people from his inner circle?
Well, that's a great question. He's very corporate in his decision-making. In other words, he surrounds himself with what he believes are the top people on any given issue, whether it's foreign policy or domestic policy. And he goes around the room, gets, you know, he encourages some dissension. He doesn't want a bunch of yes men. He gets some dissension. We saw that in this war. Some wanted to go simultaneously into Afghanistan and Iraq. Others wanted to just go into Afghanistan at first. And then he makes the final call. And the thing about Bush is that he doesn't do a lot of sort of second-guessing, you know, anguishing over his decisions after he makes them. He's kind of crisp. He makes a decision, moves on, and doesn't sort of sweat it. I think it's a real contrast to Clinton, who was almost Hamlet-esque. A lot of times
right.
He would sort of have these late-night bull sessions. And on another hand, and on the third hand, we could do this. Bush makes a decision and moves on.
Mm. Well, both of these books were captivating and very interesting, Bill. Really, really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for joining us on the book show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hope you help to have you back.
Absolutely, anytime.
All right, thanks,
Bill.
Thank
you.
Bye. That's Bill Salmon. He is White House correspondent for the Washington Times, and he's author of Fighting Back, The War on Terrorism from Inside the Bush White House, and an earlier book, At Any Cost, How Al Gore Tried to Steal the Election. All right, we're going to do America's best-selling books, top 10 in America. If I can find the list, I have it right here.
Da-na.
And this is according to the USA Today, number 10. And the 10th ranked book in America is Skipping Christmas by John Grisham. Yes, this is not a typical Grisham book.
But it's a new one, right?
It is a new one. It is a new one. And actually, it's not in the top 10, but because we're going to be interviewing this author, I'm going to mention it. Number 20, and it's brand new, just came out. The 20th ranked book in America is The Christmas Train by David Baldacci.
That'll be up in the top 10 very shortly.
I think you're right. Number 9 in the country, No Place Like Home by Fern Michaels. Number 8, oh, who's surprised about this? Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets by J.K. Rowling. Number 7, Reversible Errors by Scott Turow. Number 6 in the country, according to the USA Today, The Lovely Bones by Alice Siegel. It won't. Number 5, One Door Away from Heaven by Dean Koontz. Number 4, and this is new, Visions of Sugar Plums by Janet Ivanovich. That's another Christmas-themed book. Number 3 in the country, Chesapeake Blue by Nora Roberts. Number 2, A Series of Unfortunate Events. Number 9, The Carnivorous Carnival by Lemony Snicket, children's book. And number 1 in the country, this is unbelievable. Number 1 in the country, she's got the number 3 book in the country, but the number 1 book in the country, according to the USA Today, Table for Two by Nora Roberts. And that's the top 10.
That lady must be loaded. That's all I can say.
She must be.
I'm really curious if she actually writes all her own books, too, because how can you write that many and still, I don't know.
Maybe she's got a shadow writer.
Could be. Well, we going to take a short break and then do the contest?
All right, we're going to take a break, folks. We're going to be right back. This is The Book Show, Cutting Edge Talk About Cutting Edge Books on WLEE Hot Talk 990. We'll be right back.
Remember when you were little and the most fun you had was the fun you made for yourself? Like making a tent out of kitchen chairs and a blanket. Or pretending you were called on to make the last basket for the championship of the world. Imagination is a wonderful thing. And when you come to Luray Caverns with your kids, be sure and bring it with you. The kids will. There's no telling what their minds will see in the cave's formations. They'll be pretending that they're exploring an ancient galaxy, or hiding from spies, or looking for lost treasure. And if you've got any kid left in you, you will too.
Luray Caverns, be a caveman!
Welcome to the Book Show. I'm Alex Papajohn.
And I'm Jack Singer.
This is Cutting Edge Talk about cutting edge books, and we are going to quickly do Contest Corner.
Contest Corner, sponsored by Writer's Digest Magazine. Go to writersdigest.com for information, or you go to our website, www.thebookshow.com. You click on Contest, and there you'll see a button. You go to Writer's Digest. You can enter our contest, which requires no writing ability whatsoever. Even I can enter that, and I can't because I work here, but... you can win yourself an MP3 player and other great prizes. E-Novel, one of our sponsors, has giveaways also.
Right.
So you can go there on their front page, I noticed. You can click on that, and it has giveaways. Okay, the three of them for the day. Guideposts, a little bit of a religious note here. Young Writers Contest. Entrance must be high school juniors or seniors or equivalent in other countries. I don't know what they have in other countries, but manuscripts must be typed double-spaced, blah, 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 1,200 words or less. And specify Young Writers Contest, and the information is on our website. The next one is another high school one, High School Writers Contest. 1994, the Friends of Lovejoy Library established the High School Writers Contest. So that one's 3,000 words or less for fiction, 2,000 for nonfiction, poetry, rhymed or unrhymed, 40 words or less, and you win great prizes. The third one, if you dare enter or not, is the L. Ron Hubbard's Writers of the Future Contest. You might be taking into their cult and never get out again, but they are running a writing contest, so I figured I'd throw it out there in case anybody was interested in being in a cult. You can write and enter their contest. But otherwise, you go to thebookshow.com, our website, and click on contest, and you have all the information there. You can also get plenty of information on our previous shows. If you want to hear the whole Bill Salmon interview, we'll have it on the website, as well as all the other authors, great famous authors that we've talked to from R.L. Stine on up.
Right. Well, now next week we have David Baldacci on. He's going to talk about The Christmas Train.
Yes.
So if you want to listen to one of America's finest and most famous authors, tune into the Book Show next week. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I think The Christmas Train is out of the normal genre that he writes too,
correct,
right?
Yep.
And I'm embarrassed to say I'm not sure. Does he write fiction, right? I mean, he writes, I don't know if it's mystery or what. I'm kind of embarrassed here. I'm going to have to find out.
Well, I have to admit, I haven't read this book. I will read it before next week's show, though, and then
all
I
right,
can give
thanks,
you information
folks.
On it.